This is a fascinating machine. What is it?
This is the Atavacron. I'm sure you'll find something here that pleases you.
You are listening to the
Tricorder
Transmissions.
This appears to be an archive or library of some kind.
You may select.
And now, here are Jeff and Claire.
Atavacron has returned after a three-month hiatus. We are back on the air with our fifth episode. Tonight, we will be covering our world's influence on the second season original series episode, Bread and Circuses. I am Jeff Hewlett, and returning with me tonight is my esteemed co-host, slayer of countless super mutants, and never-ending fountain of Trek knowledge, the wonderful Claire Little.
Hello, good to be here.
Well, I am so happy to be back here with you, and it seems like only yesterday we signed off, but it was actually back, I believe, in October of 2015. So it's been a little while.
Wow. I can't believe it's been that long.
I know. Well, we've talked on other shows. I mean, you've been on Shore Leave and you were on a couple of our supplementals reflecting back on STLV. So I think we've had our share of recordings over this time. But Atavacron has been off the air for several months. But maybe it's like riding a bike. We're going to get right back on And I wish I had a Star Trek reference to use there, but I don't. Yeah. So, you know, one thing I really thought was cool about this, number one, this episode was actually a listener request from many, many months ago. So I hope that listener is still listening to the show and is here to hear his request to come to life. And one thing I really love about this episode is the fact that Ian Wolfe, Dr. Ataz from Tomorrow is Yesterday, the operator of the Atavacron that our show is named after, is actually in this episode.
That's right.
So very cool callback to the namesake here of our own episode. So fantastic stuff. I didn't even realize that he was in there until I sat down to rewatch this. I guess I had completely forgotten it.
Yeah, I hadn't. I was looking at him and thinking he looked very familiar, but I did not put those two together until you just mentioned it.
It's almost like destiny. It was meant to be. You know, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Claire, the title of this episode also holds some significance in the context of the episode.
It does. Bread and Circuses is a quote by the Roman writer Juvenal. And it's basically, well, I've got the quote here, a translation of it. It says, "Already long ago, from when we sold our vote to no man, the people have abdicated our duties. For the people, who once upon a time handed out military command, high civil office, legions, everything, now restrains itself and anxiously hopes for just two things, bread and circuses." Bread and circuses, in that quote, refer specifically to the Roman government's doling out of grain to the people, and obviously the state-sponsored and very state-publicized gladiatorial contests. In other words, food and entertainment, the two things that placated people would be happy with or need.
Yeah, in some of my research, I had read up a little bit on that as well, and it was kind of stated in the same way that you just put it, that they were, you know, the unemployed or the lower class masses would be, you know, given bread and entertainment to sort of lull them into a more pacified state. So it was definitely a control mechanism. So actually very appropriate title for the episode, given the context.
It is, definitely.
A couple of show notes here that I kind of just jotted down as I was watching this for our discussion here, that I just wanted to throw out there. And, you know, this episode stands out for a number of reasons. And For the purposes of our show, I think this episode is more chock full of real world influence than maybe any of the other episodes we've covered so far. But one thing I really thought was cool is this episode attempts to explain itself a lot more than some of the other Earth parallel episodes in the original series. In fact, it goes so far as to mention the Hodgkin's law of parallel planetary development to start to explain why they keep running into all of these Earth parallels. And that's kind of a biological theory about similar planets with similar environments and populations would tend to grow societally in the same direction. So In short, that means that any planet that has humans on it, that's sort of like Earth, will evolve in a way similar to Earth. Now, I don't know if Hodgkin's law uses Earth as its basis for comparison, as if Earth is the template. I mean, who's to say these other planets weren't the template? But I thought that was interesting that this episode has so many on-the-nose references that it's one of the only ones that also attempts to explain itself in many different times during the episode. That we can throw more of those out there. But did you think anything particular about the Hodgkin's law reference?
Yeah, I mean, I actually have a written down here, why didn't they just do an alternate dimension Earth?
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, some sort of oops, we slipped through a wormhole and yeah, just make it an alternate dimension, or don't go to such great lengths to explain it. It didn't seem like they were doing like a fourth wall kind of, or, you know, breaking the fourth wall, sort of wink and a nod to the fact that previous Star Trek episodes have essentially had mysteriously parallel Earths like the Omega Glory and Miri, and I'm sure there are others. Well, a piece of the action, which they do explain, and Pattern of Force, which again, they do explain. But it's essentially the same idea of let's explore some sort of alternate revisionist version of Earth history. It seems like they referenced enough to try and make it legitimate, but too much to make it. I don't know. As an audience member, I found it almost distracting how many times they kept saying, like, how unusual, they speak English and it's exactly like Earth. I don't know if they were trying to make a nod to the fact that this is a television show and that it's a, you know, the aliens all look like people.
Judging by the rest of the episode, there's a lot of satire that happens based on various different topics. So I took these references as the show almost lampooning itself.
Okay.
So, you know, Spock saying the points out that the aliens speak English and then says it's a complete Earth parallel. Kirk pointing out the similarity of the city being like ancient Rome, but with automobiles, mentions the composition of the steel bars in the jail cells. Yeah. I mean, they just go so over and above to let you know that this is it's so Earth-like. It just, it felt very satirical and done on purpose.
It must have been, because it was to the point that it was distracting if it wasn't intentional, you know, satirically intentional. And again, it was something that other episodes of Star Trek have done away with, and you just sort of accept it as an audience member that, gee, this is just like Earth. Okay, whatever. They're trying to tell a story. It's for the purposes of allegory. I do have to say I enjoyed the stock footage that they used to show this modern Roman city. I enjoyed the lingering shot of the MIT building. I don't know if you noticed that.
I did.
Of course you did.
I love the interspersal of the automobiles kind of driving by the bottom of the frame. And it was it looked like somebody made a lot of effort there. They put a lot of effort into making that look the way that it did.
Right. But again, they were still able to use, they didn't use a matte painting, for example. No. They were able to use perfectly ordinary stock footage of neoclassical buildings in American cities. They didn't show the Parthenon's Greek, but whatever. They didn't show any of actual Rome. Those were modern courtroom buildings and colleges. And
they just had columns, so they looked Roman.
Yeah, exactly. It's, yeah.
Yeah. You know, speaking, you mentioned matte paintings, and I'm not sure, I blame myself for not doing enough research here, but I kind of lost track of time. But you mentioned not using matte paintings, and they did do a lot of outdoor shooting for this. And I noticed, strangely, and I don't know if this is a remaster thing or if this was in the actual original episode, but when they beam down to the planet and they're on top of that giant hill, there are actually two moons in the sky.
You're right. I did notice that too. And I don't know if that's original or not, but I did. And that comes back. They reference this, the two moons, or you see them in the view screen from the Enterprise's perspective as well.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. And I have to go and pull out the Blu-ray and play the original version of it, because they would have had to have superimposed it. I mean, I guess they would be easy enough to do in the remasters, but they might have done it for consistency purposes. If it wasn't in the original cut.
I do have to wonder how having two moons, the tidal forces and of having two moons around an otherwise exactly Earth-like planet, would impact the ocean swells and the tides and everything. Would that have enough of a geological impact on the oceans to impact the development of the people living on that planet and have them skew away from their otherwise exactly parallel development? I don't know.
Well, I guess it would probably have some impact on early evolution.
Right. And but I mean, trade channel, you know, certain ocean currents might be different, which means it wouldn't have been the Romans, for example, who'd be situated to be successful. Maybe it would be some other
Patterns,
civilization. Yeah. I mean, who knows?
Which could completely change where ground is fertile and, you know, where crops can grow. And yeah, especially in the early days before, you know, industrialized distribution of water.
Exactly.
Yeah. So there's a lot to unpack here. So here's another hour and a half of conversation.
That's it. I don't need to go any further down that path.
Okay. Well, I'll divert the path. And this is something else before we get into some of the other real world influences here. This is something that made me go down a thought rabbit hole. There is a bit of conversation where Spock is talking about the people, the number, millions of people who died in Earth's world wars, while they're having a little argument about the merits or non-merits of the Roman way of life. And Spock mentions that 37 million people died in Earth's third world war. Now, my mind is running in circles at the melding of ancient Earth history, the 60s present day that they were using to base the technology on, and this future theorized history.
Which is now the past for
right.
us.
Right.
Because but I believe the future that for was them? Supposed, yeah, it was supposed to be in the 90s, the eugenics war.
Yes.
But then First Contact and Next Generation's first and last episodes kind of push that out to the mid 21st century. So not sure exactly when that third slash, maybe we had two, maybe it was a fourth world war happen. I don't know.
I love the fact that you have all of these different time periods and one that's completely fictional, all kind of converging in one episode. It's such a strange mixture.
Definitely.
So, one final point before we move on. I know I mentioned this in my commentary on this episode, a long, long time ago when we covered it, but the dialogue exchange between Spock and McCoy in the jail cell is one of my favorite exchanges between the two of them in the entire series.
I 100% agree. I ran it back and watched it 3 times. It's so good.
Yeah. It hits you right in the heart. I mean, you can feel for both of them. It's so great.
Yeah. And I actually wrote down that it's easily one of the top 5 character moments for the entire like original series cast, you know, from the show and their movies. Easily top 5 in my opinion. Just
absolutely
the whole like part of the show.
Yeah, the nonverbal acting by Leonard Nimoy as he's just listening to what McCoy is saying to him, and you can see the look on his face, and you're like, oh my god, McCoy's getting to him. The emotion's getting to him, and then he just snaps right back into the Vulcan persona.
But I feel like he gives McCoy a little glimpse when he looks back at him and says, really? He looks very, he doesn't look emotional in the sense that he doesn't look sad or upset, but he looks less harsh than he usually does.
Yeah, a little
and
softer.
I feel like in that moment, McCoy kind of pulls back too and realizes that he's gone a little far. He found kind of a soft underbelly spot to target on Spock, and he went further maybe than he was really proud to have gone, because you can tell that his moment of understanding doesn't include sympathy. It includes a jab.
Yes.
He takes it in a kind of an unpleasant direction. Although I will admit I'm completely biased, because every time McCoy gets on Spock, I'm like yelling at my TV for McCoy to knock it off. So I'm very pro Spock in that sense, in all senses, really. But I think the look on McCoy's face when it shifts and he says, I know I miss him too. I feel like McCoy is kind of drawing back a little bit, because he realizes he has actually managed to maybe wound a little bit Spock, and he feels bad about it or not proud of it. I don't know. I think they both did a fantastic job in that scene.
I agree. I like that McCoy ended it with an empathetic moment. At least he tied them back together, and he kind of went back to what makes them very similar, as opposed to all of the things he was picking Spock apart for, and how, you know, he's burying his emotions and not letting his human side come out. But, you know, McCoy acknowledges that even though the human side is buried, they share that concern for Kirk, which is lifeblood of the show. So.
Absolutely. And I do love the fact that even though McCoy, I think, takes advantage of this too with his remarks. Mm-hmm. I do love the fact that McCoy is constantly aware that no matter how many times Spock claims not to have emotions, that that is crap. And he does those emotions. McCoy just sits there with that sort of smirky smile on his face, like, you are full of it and you might be fooling everyone else, but you're not fooling me.
Yeah, that's the perfect way to sum that up.
Yeah.
So are you ready to dive into some of these real world influences on Bread and Circuses?
I am, yes.
Okay. Well, I think I will tee us off with what is probably the most obvious and heavy-handed influence, and that would be the Roman Empire. The episode really traces back to ancient Rome, and there are some very different things. I mean, I know this is a television show and it's dramatized for entertainment purposes, but it makes a lot of references to slaves being used in gladiatorial combat, which, of course, did happen. But I think some background statistics on slavery in Rome may help to round out the discussion a little bit. So some of the research that I did, I found some interesting numbers. It seems around 35% of the people in Italy during the Roman Empire, at least at the height of the Roman Empire, were slaves, which actually made Rome a what they call a slave society, where slaves constitute at least a fifth of the population and, of course, played a major role in the economy of that society. So, and it was a very complex institution. They do get into it a little bit in the episode. Flavius does a little bit of expose on the life of a slave, which sort of parallels a little bit of what it was like in ancient Rome, but it was a little more complicated in real life. So in urban settings in Rome, slaves could be professionals, teachers, doctors, chefs, working in finance, and a lot of them, or the majority of them, were trained. So they weren't all unskilled labor, although they did have those as well. They did have the slave that we're the most familiar with, which is the forced worker who has to work in the fields or toil in the house somewhere against their will. But agriculture, of course, mining and milling relied on those exploitative slaves. So outside of Italy, there was a little less of a slave population, mostly 10 to 20%. In Roman Egypt and some in the Greek areas were around those numbers. Slaves being forced to fight in gladiatorial combat was fairly common, but they didn't always fight to the death. So the show implies that a lot of the combat was to the death, but that was actually more of a rarity, especially when you would consider that a lot of the gladiators that were slaves were very well trained in how to fight, and all of the investment that was put into training them made them valuable. So their owners who were entering them into these gladiatorial matches wouldn't be very happy with the loss of all of that investment. So there were actually referees in a lot of these bouts that would stop these fights once a serious wound was levied, so that they could actually get medical attention in there and save them and not lose that investment. So I have a few other notes here, but Claire, I want to stop for a minute and see if you had any thoughts on any of that.
I was just wondering if you happen to have in front of you any information on what the attendance was like, numbers of attendance for people coming to see gladiatorial combat. Obviously, there are a lot of coliseums and arenas, you know, in European and North African cities. So the Romans built plenty of them. But of course, you had to be present to see this. And I don't know what kind of percentage of the urban population was able to come see these events and if they saw them frequently. And then, of course, if you were living in a rural population, you're not probably going to be in the cities very often to see these events. Was it as hugely popular as this episode makes it seem? And also sort of the way we tend to think about it as being, you know, like the equivalent of football or something for the ancient Romans. Was it really that commonly witnessed and enjoyed?
That's a wonderful question, and I wish I had the statistics to back it up. Unfortunately, I do not. All I had was the statistics around the percentages of people who were the slave population. I would imagine it was probably mostly the people in the larger cities that had access to these games, but I do know that it didn't matter where you fell in the societal hierarchy, you were allowed to go to the games and watch them and be entertained by them and even partake in some of the food and drink that was distributed throughout the Colosseum. But I will have to look up some of those other numbers and get back to you.
Oh, that's okay. I could have looked that up myself, but the question didn't occur to me until just now. Another thing I was wondering about, and if this is something you'll talk about later, you can tell me that and we'll answer it later. Between your statistics about the population in the urban centers in Italy that were slaves and Juvenal's original quote about people sort of giving away their civic duties in place of comforts, do you happen to know what percentage of the population was actually able to vote, was considered a citizen? I know that it was not a large percentage and that obviously women were not voting citizens. Slaves, I would assume, couldn't vote, but you might know otherwise. And I think maybe younger men, we're not citizens. So I'm kind of wondering, of this group that Juvenal is talking about as being sort of complacent in their civic duties, how many of them were actually able to participate in civic duties?
That's another good question. I don't have a direct answer, but I do have some information on laws pertaining to slavery, which does mention the right to vote. So it doesn't necessarily differentiate between sexes, but what I did find about that was that there were some very complicated, intricate laws around the concept and the practice of slavery under Roman law. Slaves were considered property, of course, and had no legal personhood, but a slave could be freed by their owners, and they would actually be granted the right to vote once they were able to get citizenship. So that was only in Rome, though, from what I could tell. It was different from the Greek city-states. They did not allow freed slaves to become citizens, but a slave who belonged to a Roman citizen enjoyed not only passive freedom from ownership, but active personal freedom as well, including the right to vote.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, I find that very interesting as well, because you study different forms of slavery throughout our own history, and it's amazing how much more intricate Roman slavery laws were. I mean, there are some things in here that are very much like some of the other forms of slavery we know about. So, slaves could be subjected to corporal punishment, sexual exploitation, of course, torture, and even execution if deemed necessary. Although there were some strange regulations around rape of slaves, I don't want to get too heavy into this, but the way that the laws were written, rape could only be committed against free people. So if you were a slave, it didn't count. But in other respects, you could be charged with property damage if you raped someone else's slave. Because
wow.
They were considered property. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, I guess that's good for the person who was the slave who was raped, that there can at least be some legal recourse. But boy, that is a really unpleasant way to have to consider the whole thing. I mean, that's extremely dehuman. It's almost worse than if there just was no prosecution at all in terms of the treatment of the slave who was raped. But
yeah, I suppose
wow.
you could be raped by the people that owned you, the family, and other slaves,
yeah.
I guess, in that group. But if someone outside of that perpetrated the same crime, then they could be prosecuted, but not
right.
necessarily for what they did, but for damaging you or potentially damaging you.
Wow.
It's a strange concept.
It is. I wonder if that has anything to do. I would love to know how Roman sexual mores play, if they have anything to do with the way that law was written, because, and again, this might be an exaggeration or not very accurate, but we tend to think of Romans as being very kind of sexually adventurous and very bacchanalian in their lives. I wonder if that has something to do with the way they wrote that law, or if they just flat out really did not care about the sort of human aspect of a slave being raped.
Well, yeah, I don't have any definitive evidence, but I suppose that, since a lot of slaves that they had were actually conquered people, from other societies, maybe they really did think of them as property and just didn't you didn't count as a human being because you weren't even a fellow Roman. It's not like you were enslaving, you know, a fellow, you know, Roman from down the street. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, that we, you know, our warriors just went out and they destroyed this village that didn't want to comply. And here's the inhabitants of that village. Let's distribute them as labor. And therefore, you know, they didn't even consider you valuable, you know, as a human being. So,
yeah, I'd love to bring that back up later on when we talk about Drusilla, the female slave in the episode, if we want to talk about that later.
Well, sure. Or we could segue right into that now if you'd like.
Oh, that's fine with me. But I just didn't want to redirect your train of thought. Well, skipping ahead for most of the plot, I guess we're assuming everyone who's listening has watched this episode or remembers it or looked it up on Memory Alpha really quickly before they hit play. So near the end of the episode, Kirk has been sort of passively and actively resisting the wishes of the leader of the Roman planet to basically, he wants Kirk to bring everyone from the Enterprise down so that they can live as gladiators and be entertainment, et cetera, et cetera. And Kirk is not interested in that for various reasons, obviously. And near the end of the episode, Kirk finds himself alone with the personal slave of the head of the Romans, whose name I forgot.
The proconsul?
Thank you. Yes, the proconsul. So Kirk finds himself in the proconsul's chambers alone with Drusilla, his slave. And Drusilla is now wearing an extremely revealing, super sexy outfit, which is different than her drab sort of prison uniform looking normal slave outfit. And it quickly becomes apparent to the audience and to Kirk that she is his sex slave for the night. And they are alone and she's there to serve him and he's there to be served. And I found this scene, which it's about, I don't know, maybe 5 to 8 minutes in length in total. It's interrupted in the middle with the excellent Spock and McCoy jail scene. I found this entire scene to be extremely uncomfortable for a lot of reasons. But the primary one is that Kirk ends up having sex with her and willingly, and it's really weird. So Drusilla is portrayed by the show as being a very consenting, willing participant. You know, again, she's dressed very sexily. The music in the scene is the kind of sexy woman, sort of generic sexy woman music that is sometimes used. It looks like they've got soft focus on the lens. I mean, she's done up very much as the here's Kirk's conquest for the episode, kind of what you expect. There's no real mention of the fact that this might be an morally inappropriate conquest. In fact, Kirk only hesitates because he refuses to be the entertainment for the proconsul. He's uncomfortable with the fact that he would be giving in to something the proconsul has sort of arranged for him, not with the fact that he would be engaging in sex with a sex slave who is a sex slave. And I don't mean to use that phrase a whole bunch of times, but this episode seems to immediately forget. And I feel like I need to remind it that she's a sex slave. Don't have sex with her, Kirk. So again, Drusilla acts in a very accommodating manner, but the episode has portrayed or made clear that, you know, slaves can get punished in other ways. And so no matter how Drusilla might be behaving, we can never know if internally she is interested in engaging in this behavior. So it's not a consenting relationship, Kirk. Don't do it. Hmm. But he does it. and so, and you know, Drusilla bats her eyes and acts very demure and says things like, command me. And, you know, she's very accommodating because it's her job to be, because she is, say it with me now, a sex slave. It's her unwilling job. And so I just find this entire scene awkward. I also think I would love to know if, as an audience member in the 1960s, if they thought there was anything wrong with it. Are we supposed to be, I mean, usually we root for Kirk to get the girl. It's what he does. He's our hero. I don't think, I certainly was not rooting for him to actually get the girl in this case because it seemed very wrong to me. But I don't know if that was intentional. This episode does a lot of has a lot of jabs at television and audience manipulation in terms of dramatic tension and excitement and ratings. And I know we'll talk about that later. So I don't know if this scene was an intentional poke at the fact that the audience is supposed to be rooting for our hero to get the girl, but in doing so, you're rooting for our hero to engage in something extremely morally repugnant. I don't know if that was intentional. It might have been. It worked very well for me if it was. But yeah, I kind of rambled a little bit there.
No, that's right. No? You gave me a lot of food for thought. I thinking back on it, now, I knowing the satirical nature of most of this episode, I don't know if this particular scene was directly influenced by the author's knowledge of Rome. I don't know if he was just trying to show another side of slavery or author's discretion thrown in there. That's a little more disturbing to me that it's not meant to illustrate anything. Like if it was meant to be something thought provoking, that's one thing. But if it was just put in there as a, you know, let Kirk get some kind of moment, that's a little bit off-putting. During the very beginning of the scene where Kirk is resisting, every time I watch the episode, I keep wanting him to do the right thing. I'm like, okay,
exactly.
You're on the right path here, Kirk. You're doing the right thing. And then, okay, he's doing it for the wrong reasons, but he's still doing the right thing. And then he just gives in for no apparent reason other than, I don't know, because he felt like it.
Yeah, I felt exactly the same way. And his hesitation at the beginning, I was really glad about it. And then when he starts to sort of speak to the proconsul, though he's not there, I realized that his hesitation had nothing to do with the moral issue of basically engaging in slavery, and because that's what he did. He used a slave. It has nothing to do with that and everything to do with the fact that he doesn't want to look like he's cooperating with his captors, like he's enjoying the fruits of captivity, basically. And again, Drusilla repeatedly, her dialogue is super subservient.
Yes, like, it is.
Really subservient. Command me. And, you know, I've never lied to one who owns me. She's really driving it home. Kirk cannot forget that she is a slave and her job that night is to have sex with him as like her job as a slave. You know, this is not a case of a sex worker who's off duty choosing to have sex with someone else because people like to have sex with each other. And this is, she's not off duty. She can't be. She's a slave. And she repeatedly says that her duty that night is to be his slave. So again, like there's no confusion to me. I just find the whole thing so awkward. And I think if it was intended to be kind of an intentional moment to make the audience uncomfortable and to point out hypocrisy between, you know, wanting your hero to get the girl versus, you know, satire or I think have pushed a little harder on that, considering how unsubtle so many of the other pieces of satire are in this episode that are about different things. The subtlety factors are not equal there, or lack of subtlety.
Yeah, good point.
I'm like, well, there's that other half of Kirk from The Enemy Within rearing his ugly head again.
I was just gonna say that this one ranks right up there with the Janice Rand scene.
Yeah.
The sexual assault scene. Those are probably the two most off-putting moments in the original series, I think.
Anyway, so I'm done talking about that now, but thank you for letting me. I just the whole time was like, stop it, Kirk, don't.
It's quite all right. I from a real world influence aspect, it is very interesting food for thought, though, to wonder the genesis of that scene. Now, I've read the passage in, you know, Mark Cushman's These Are the Voyages, Volume 2 book about Bread and Circuses. And I didn't see anything in there about that scene and the genesis of that scene in particular. So I can't shed any more light on what the intent behind it was.
Well, and the fact that it segues immediately afterwards, I mean, you see Kirk waking up in bed alone to the proconsul coming in and saying to Kirk, literally saying, Kirk, you're a man, so I'm going to give it to you like a man. And, yes, you know, I respect you. It's very, having those two scenes butt right up against each other with no cut to another scene or cut to anything else. It's very much like they just, and again, maybe this is the proconsul interpreting masculinity differently because he's Roman. I don't know, but really just the sex slave scene reinforcing the sort of traditional masculine, you know, a real man, he's gonna die like a man. There's a lot of weird stuff happening right there. And yeah, the more I think about it, the more it seems less like intentional satire, even though I would like it to be intentional satire. I don't know if I can fully be an apologist for that.
No, you're convincing me more and more. It's getting harder and harder to look at it that way.
Yeah, and again, that how bold the satire is for other things in the episode.
Correct.
Again, the level is so different.
It certainly
is. Okay, now I'm really done.
Yeah, no, the proconsul really sells it. Since Kirk is going to die, this was like a gentleman's courtesy, right? You know, one man to another. I'm going to give you your last rites as a man and, you know, let you go out on a high point. You know, you got some and you had your wine and your feast, you know, all these things that men are quote unquote want as men. So he's going to make sure Kirk got what he always wanted before he departs.
Yeah. I mean, the proconsul is really like a pimp sharing his whore out of courtesy. It's really unpleasant.
Yeah, it's very unpleasant. And I think it reflects on Kirk as a character quite poorly. And, you know, I it's a shame that moments like that had to occur for such an iconic character.
Yeah, I have no problem at all with him, you know, having conquests and lots of different conquests in the show. I mean, it's almost a running joke at this point. Like, how many girlfriends did he have at the Academy, or how many years was he at the Academy, given the number of girlfriends he apparently had? I honestly, when it's a consensual relationship, go for it. It's just when it's not consensual, that's not good on you, Kurt.
No, wouldn't it have been a much better moment, a much more Star Trek moment, if it wound up being, say, the you know, Kirk is there in the room and like the proconsul's wife comes in and wants Kirk to help her escape or something. She's a, you know, free person, and then Kirk has that as a conquest, you know.
Yeah, just anyone capable of consenting, anyone who is acting on their own volition and not because they are considered a piece of property, and if they refuse to behave the way their owner wants, they could be killed. Yeah, that doesn't make for a good conquest.
No, and you know, Kirk also has a bit of a history of standing up for the oppressed,
which he does.
Even flies more in the face in this. You know, thinking of an episode like The Cloudminders, where Kirk, you know, goes way over and above to champion the cause of the enslaved.
Definitely. I mean, or Gangsters of Triskelion.
Yes.
You've got other enslaved gladiator combatants, basically. And I don't know that I don't think Kirk has like a full relationship, but there's obviously an object of affection. Yeah, again, he usually strives to liberate the people who are oppressed, or at least give them the tools to liberate themselves, but not this time.
No, not this time. All right. So that was pretty heavy.
It was. Thank you, everyone, for listening to that, if you did.
All right. And on that heavy topic, I think we're going to pause here and end part one of our coverage of Bread and Circuses. And we will be back with our part two very shortly. But Claire, this has been a very fun and enlightening discussion, as always.
Thank you. It certainly has. All your facts about the Roman demographics were really interesting.
Oh, thank you. And I really enjoyed going through some of these notes on the episode itself with you. And I think we have some other food for future thought. Maybe we can do a supplemental log exploring some of these concepts that we don't have a lot of time to talk about on a Tavacron, but could be interesting discussions in their own right.
Definitely.
All right. So, Claire, where can the audience find you if they would like to talk to you?
I am on Twitter. My handle is IsolinearChick. That's IsolinearChick.
Awesome. And I am J_BENJ on Twitter. And you can also get us on the tricordertransmissions.com, facebook.com/thetricordertransmissions. And on Twitter, we're TTT_pod. And we will see you next time on a Tavacron episode 6. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.